are in Galatians chapter 4, the end of it. As the argument of Paul's continues, he says in verse 21, "Tell me, you who want to be under law, do you not listen to the law?" Kind of an interesting question. So he's speaking to those that have been influenced by the Judaizers, saying, "So if you want to be under the law, do you not really listen to the law?" So he's going to go back and give a historical perspective on Isaac and Ishmael, and then he's going to speak of it by allegory, and then a personal perspective. So he begins, he says, "For it was written that Abraham had two sons, one by the bondwoman and one by the free woman. But the son by the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and the son by the free woman through the promise." So he looks at these this historical perspective of Abraham's sons, and he draws these differences. And as you'll recall, God made a promise that Abraham would have a son, and that the world's going to be blessed through his, you know, through that generations of you know, his kids. And it seems pretty improbable that that could actually happen because of their age. And then they wait, and finally decide, well, probably what God meant wasn't with Sarah, but with somebody else. And so he takes and Hagar and has Ishmael as a son. But here, it makes a distinction between these two. It says, Abraham had two sons, one by a bondwoman, so one by a slave, and one by a free woman. But the son by the bondwoman was according to the flesh, and the son by the free woman through the promise. So the differences, he draws out two differences here. One is that there are two different mothers, and they're distinguished as being slave and free. And then there's two different orientations in the birth. One is that it's according to the flesh, and the other that it is through the promise. So one is that it's, if you would, natural, and the other one is it's somewhat supernatural, somewhat different. And in Hebrews, it says, "By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised." So, you know, as Abraham and Sarah looked at it initially, it was like, well, this isn't going to work. And the time was running out, in their opinion. And so Ishmael is born according to the flesh. So there's a natural aspect to that birth. But Isaac was born through the promise, that there's something different about this one. It was natural in the sense of natural conception and so forth, but it wasn't natural in the circumstances surrounding it. It wasn't expected, and yet it was according, it was in line with the promise. It was through the promise. And so Paul brings that historical perspective in. And then he makes an allegory of this. That is, he takes what has occurred and he paints a picture of it. In verse 24 he says, "This is allegorically speaking, for these women are two covenants." Well, the women aren't actually two covenants. But there's something about the two women in the situation that appropriately fit looking at different covenants. one proceeding from Mount Sinai, bearing children who are to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now, this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children. So, looks at this one and says, this is according to flesh, and this is a slavery, and it has to do with the law. When the law was given, there's a bondage here. And it has to do with the you know, here's Jerusalem, the physical Jerusalem, the heart, the head of the Jewish nation. And all this has to do with this kind of physical law. But on the other hand, it says, but the Jerusalem above is free. She is our mother. And then he makes a citation here. It says, for it is written, rejoice, barren woman, who does not bear. Break forth and shout, you who are not in labor. For more numerous are the children of the desolate than of the one who has a husband. And that's a citation from Isaiah, looking at when the nation will be called back. It says, and you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. So, in this allegory, saying the one mother is like the law, but the other mother is a promise. The one child is like the Mosaic law, if you would. The other child is like the promise or the new covenant. It's kind of interesting when you think about the covenants in that regard, that the things associated with the law are things that are generally put in terms of thou shalt, thou shalt not. But the things of the new covenant and of the promise with Abraham are, which the new covenant is more of a fulfillment of that, is the God saying, I will. And what differences? When the directives are, you shall, we cannot fulfill those. And those become burdensome. But when it's, I will, it's a totally different perspective. And so he draws these out, and these two women out, and says they're like two different covenants. The Mosaic covenant and the new covenant. Or the promise with Abraham, which, fits very well into the new covenant, probably in that thinking. So Paul likens them in that sense, not saying that those passages were allegorically to be understood, and that they, there's just an allegory that never existed. But he's taking that historical concept and say, it forms a picture like this. And then with that, then he moves into a personal perspective in 28-31. He says, and you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. So, speaking to the Christians, now these are Christians at Galatia that would look back and say, well, we accepted Christ by faith, but since that time we're really embracing the law for living the Christian life. But he's saying, you're like Isaac, you're children of promise. But at that time, he who was born according to the flesh persecuted him who is born according to the Spirit. So it is now also. So there is almost a sense here he's saying you should expect persecution. You are children of the promise, and children of promise should expect persecution. Go back in Genesis in the early life of Isaac. Ishmael is said to have mocked him. Genesis 21:9, I believe. What I'm trying to get to. But my Bible doesn't seem to be able to get there. Should have just let. Then Jacob, 21. So, in this passage, it's on the birth of Isaac, and in verse 1, it says, then the Lord took note of Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had promised.
So she conceived, etc. And then in verse 8 it says, and the child grew and was weaned. So, you know, somewhere maybe around the age of 3, and there's some type of a celebration or a recognition of this time period, and the child grew, and there was this feast. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. And she says, therefore, she said to Abraham, drive out this maid and her son. Well, you know, there's this sense here that the one that was born of the promise is persecuted. So the one born according to the flesh is persecuting the one born according to the promise, and this is according to the Spirit here. And so that continues now. Well, Jesus, you know, basically said the same thing to his disciples. If they persecuted me, surely you could expect that they're going to persecute you. And so that's one of the things that we see here, that, you know, as these Judaizers come in and cause these kind of problems, is as though they're saying, you ought to expect that. Those of the law are going to persecute those that are the promise. And then the rest of it, he might be thought of as saying that, you know, yet be certain of the promise. Be certain of the promise. Continues, he says, but what does the Scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son. For the son of the bondwoman shall not be an heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of a bondwoman, but of the free woman. Now, the interesting thing, and we do have that passage that we just read the first of in Genesis, where Sarah tells Abraham that, and God confirms it, yet he does take care of Hagar and Ishmael. Still, it has that passage, they're cast out. Well, Jews would have, up to this time, would have read that passage and said, see, we're of the free woman, the Gentiles are the ones cast out. Paul has taken this and reversing it. They're looking at it as they have under a strictly physical thing, saying, we are descendants of Abraham. But Jesus challenge that. And Paul likewise is that it's not about physical descendants, it's about spiritual descendants. So here he looks at this and he says, the Judaizers are of the bondwoman. Those who have trusted Christ, which at this point would include Jews and Gentiles, are of the promise. And so he reverses what would have generally been understood in this passage. And, you know, so with this passage, he has a way of arguing, you know, as it's been through the whole book, of arguing based upon the law, based upon Jewish history, of showing that the law is not the way to a relationship or to a higher relationship with God, and that it was never designed that way. Even to the point here of saying that the relationship under the law, you know, is contrary, you know, as he's elsewhere, is contrary to that, is the one under the promise. But also saying we should expect persecution. Now, you could expect persecution from those that oppose God, but here the persecution, as in what we often see, the persecution comes from those that are religious. And that's the persecution of you here. So when the Judaizers come in and they start making fun of people, or they start, you know, setting it up that, oh, y'all aren't as, you know, as spiritual as we are, y'all are just those dummies that, you know, believe the Bible, you know, there's a sense of persecution. And that happens often today. I mean, there is that sense of, within the liberal aspects of Christianity, that you're just not enlightened. you know, you're so foolish you believe the Bible. You don't understand that it's just, you know, it's just a book, or it's just one of many means of God speaking to us. And there's an intellectual snobbery that, you know, comes in this sense of persecution. It's so interesting when you hear things quoted when people are doing some kind of study or whatever on the TV, that it is rare that you'll ever see an evangelical scholar cited. And if you see something on ABC or CBS or NBC and they're doing something on some religious aspect, it will almost always be a professor from Yale or Harvard or wherever. Seldom will you see anyone else. Now, there was with the Da Vinci Code, Dr. Bach from Dallas Seminary sometimes was included in those conversations because he had written a book on it. But very seldom you see evangelicals. But even within that religious aspect, that occurs. And so I think that's partly what Paul is saying here. And so he's gone through this, you know, which really brings us to the end of this chapter, which the next two are much more, as Paul's typical writings are, they don't divide necessarily in the middle, but they divide between a theological foundation and a more applicational part. And so this will make that transition. But as, you know, as we've gone back, you know, his arguments have come from the Old Testament over and over again, which is appropriate because that's what he's citing. That's what he's dealing with, those that say it's of the law. But he keeps going back and showing the law could never do that. The law was never about that. Don't you understand the history? Oh, you want to be under the law? Well, do you understand what the law is saying? The law is saying that, you know, if you want to be under it, then, you know, this is, you know, that would be Hagar and Ishmael because Isaac and Sarah, they're related to the promise, not to the law. And it even makes that comparison, saying, see, if you're going to make a comparison, one would be Mount Sinai, the law was given, and that would be Hagar and Ishmael, but Sarah and Isaac, they're the promise. And so it's a very interesting argument that he goes through. One that's, you know, somewhat difficult for us from the standpoint that that's not our immediate history, but yet it drives it home over and over again of that the law cannot save, the law cannot be the means to spirituality. It was never designed for that. Never could accomplish that. And if we are foolish enough to say we began with grace, but now we're going to move forward with keeping the list, it makes no sense at all. Well, any thoughts or insights or your questions or... I think
my concern is with you know, whether we can look at that with a plain hermeneutic as opposed to spiritualizing things, which you know, that's a whole.
I don't think you could look at I don't think you could read Genesis and say, oh, see, you know, Hagar and Ishmael are like the law, and I don't think you could ever get that there. I think that, yeah, I think that's coming from an argument, right? I think that's revelation.
Okay.
I don't think that you would necessarily get that. Now, I think this one's different from that because he's right. Yeah, that's the problem you get into. You know, like the all millennials, and then it's all allegory.
But there's no basis for the allegory. It's just however they want, you know. There's no standard, and that's what's make it hard. I think the thing here with Paul, you know, he says this is allegory, and he paints this picture, and he's showing these two things, but at the same time in doing that, it's also showing, you know, a passage that they would have taken one way because of saying it's physical, but Jesus didn't take it that way. You know, Jesus was saying that, you know, God can raise up what stones to be children of Abraham. You know, we're, you know, talking about physical. You know, we're talking about spiritual, and so that you know switches that around. But I think, you know, it's different to take an allegory and make an application, which is what Paul's doing, than to do it and to say this is what it means. So I don't think even Paul here is saying that that's what that passage, you know, meant. But I think it is interesting in when you look back, because you read that passage in Genesis, and Sarah seems pretty mean. And God agrees, and that seems pretty mean. But then he's nice, you know, going to take care of him, but it's kind of, huh? And then, you know, with Paul comes in here and you go, oh, okay, I'm not seeing the connection. That there's some other things here. So it does seem like there was some allowances given. So I don't know that you could ever read the Genesis passage and appropriately say this is what it meant, apart from seeing Paul's theology tying into it. But there's... the way it's tied in, it's not just that he made a picture, an allegory of it, but you do see some things that really laid the groundwork for it. There's something else there, and you start saying, okay, we didn't really catch, you know, when I read Genesis, I really didn't catch the significance of the promise and the significance of trying to do this by the flesh and the law and the distinction there. But I don't think you could get it from there. And I think that is an insight that is that revelation in a direct sense, or is that God teaching Paul? I don't really know how he, you know, did it. Well, now he just go, oh, or is that through kind of studying and God, but. Well,
because, you know, how can we just say, well, you know, that we approach things plainly first, you know, and,
yeah,
you know, it's almost as though they look upon themselves as having a
special
insight.
Yeah.
If not revelation.
The thing that got me, when I was at Dallas Seminary, you know, I guess I had two kind of things at various times, but one was, you know, why am I dispensational? I mean, you know, when I became a Christian, I started attending a Bible church that was dispensational. And because of that influence, I went to Dallas Seminary. So, therefore, I'm dispensational by happenstance, just because I happened to go to, that was the church I went to. And that bothered me. And so I started reading All Millennialists. And the All Mill would say, if you interpret the Bible literally, you'll be dispensational. You know, so I wasn't reading the dispensational that would say that, but the All Mill was saying that. And I couldn't figure out a reason not to interpret it that way. And when you read different people on prophecy, or, you know, Old Testament passages, there's no basis for how they're interpreting. And if you read different commentators, they're saying this, they're saying different things about the passage. Because when you spiritualize it, there's no standard for it. Anything can mean anything.
And I think that's one thing that makes whole allegory more solid, is that it fits in with the things we know.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's a killer, but
And he's making a distinction between, and you can see it's kind of physical and spiritual because he talks about Jerusalem now and then this Jerusalem above. So you get the physical, spiritual distinction that's a little different than just, you know, making up stuff. And that's so off. That's the part that I struggle with the all millennial, is just the, there doesn't seem to be a, there's no standard for why it's this or that. Now, they may generally agree on some things, but it's just generally agreeing, not because there's a standard in it. The other thing that in seminary that, and I don't know, it bothered me a lot in seminary, but after seminary I was like, you know, why am I non-charismatic? Or almost, you know, probably at that time, pretty anti-charismatic. And, you know, again, it's like, well, that's the church I went to and that's the seminary I went to. And so I thought, okay, I've got to read somebody on this, but I had to read, you know, I knew I couldn't get somebody that's just all emotional or something that, you know, had no basis, because that, I, you know, that wouldn't work for me. So I found a book that was published by InterVarsity Press, and, you know, on charismatic, and, you know, pro-charismatic. So I thought, okay, that's where we go. So I'm reading this guy, and he's talking about rules for interpreting dreams. And he comes up, you know, he has these 10 or 12 rules for interpreting dreams. And it's kind of like, where do you get these rules? And he makes up rules. This is how you know what a dream means, because da-da-da. Well, you just make them up. And that makes no sense to me. And I think, you're obviously, we're going to come to some of those things differently as far as how we approach them or how we become settled on things. But, you know, I think if you read a book, and you can get these books, different approaches to prophecy or something, and there's a book that has four views in it, and they present their view, and then they argue against, you know, the other one's views and stuff, and you can see kind of some of their major points or why they hold those, and that gives you a good overview. But also, if you just get commentaries on prophetic books in the, of the Old Testament, and get different commentaries by all millennials, and they're just, you know, off the board. Now, if you get dispensationalists, it's not like they're all going to agree on everything. But their approach to it is going to be the same. I mean, they may interpret the passages different, but they're not just coming up and saying this, you know, this means this and that means, you know, this picture has to mean this. Out of, you know, why? Well, because it makes sense to me. That's why. So I think that's different. And I think the thing here with Paul that's different, kind of what Wynn was saying, that it is supported elsewhere in Scripture, but he's saying that it's allegory. He's painting this picture, but it becomes in that sense of an application, because he's already given the historical facts, and now it becomes this application as he distinguishes between the physical and the spiritual. And then that does, at that point, then it does give you pause and some insight, maybe in the old passage, Old Testament, that you're going, well, maybe when I look at that passage and see God is being really cruel, going along with this wicked suggestion, that maybe I kind of missed part of it. You know, how different. And that at that point we realize that we look at that Abraham being with Hagar and Ishmael as a lack of faith. You know, it was a faith issue, which it was. But it's more than that. It's more than a faith issue. It's obliterating the promise. And thus it puts it back in the sense of law. It puts it back in another format. And I wouldn't get that. You know, now, could you get that by reading the Old Testament? I think so. And I'm sure other people have, by, you know, tracing and, you know, the insights of saying, hey, this is going to... I wouldn't get it, I can tell you that. But when Paul throws it out, that, you know, that way, and you look back at it and you say, oh,
Yeah, that part is there.
Yes. And, you know, it's clear in this, you know, in that sense, it's, you know, that aspect of application. So, well, other thoughts or questions? Or I meant to look that up to give a definite. We'll put Rob in charge of that for next week. But you're... It, in a general sense, it's where a story has a, means something else, has another story to it. So here's the story, but allegorically it's referring to something else. So... sure about it. She does anything to do with it. What other prayer requests?